Okay, let me just kick off with one quick question that was left kindly up here. Is there any difference between the new heaven and new earth promised in Isaiah 65 and the one promised in Revelation? Probably not. The thing about Isaiah 65, I mean, you know, new heavens, new earth, you know, it sounds like a join the dots kind of phrase, doesn't it? Go all the way through to the new heavens and the new earth. The only slight issue with some of the Isaiah material is that people still die. So never again will there be in it infants who live but a few days, or older people do not live out their years. Those who died 100 will be thought mere youths. Those who failed to reach 100 consider accursed, and so on. Well, some people say this can't be the new heavens and the new earth, because while you'll never have a child who dies a few days old, as in there'll never be a tragedy like that, you'll never have an older person who doesn't live out their years, there seems to be an implication they still die. Now, at the moment, I reckon, I'm working on the basis that is a picturesque way of saying you don't die. It's like, you know, if you died at 100, you'd be considered accursed in the new creation. In other words, it won't happen. Of course you won't die at 100. But someone could come back to me saying, no, but they seem to think they will die at some point. And that's a fair, I have to go, yep, hands up, I acknowledge that. But the rest of it, in terms of the new heavens and the new earth, and the wolf and the lamb will feed together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox, and so on, they'll neither harm nor destroy my holy mountain. That sounds pretty much like the harmony of the new creation. If it isn't the new creation, then potentially it is kind of God's restoration of his people post-exile, because it includes things like, you know, I will create Jerusalem to be a delight and its people a joy. I will rejoice over Jerusalem and take delight in my people. The sound of weeping and crying will be heard in it no more. And so one possibility is to say, look, it's like a picture of, hang on a second, like a picture of wonderful restoration following the exile, but in such grand terms you end up saying it can't really truly be fulfilled just then. It must be looking further ahead. And so in that sense you say, well, it's partially about people re-establishing themselves in the promised land and God delighting in them there, but looking forward to the new heaven and the new earth. So, question?
Just a premillennialist, of course, would say that's the best.
Yes. Now, that's absolutely right. Pre-millennialists would point to this. I can't think of any other passages, but certainly this one, where they'd say, here's a passage which describes a wonderful time on earth, but that isn't the new creation. And so that would be their explanation of it. Yeah, thank you. Good. Glad that's all cleared up. Let's reflect on living in the last days. I take it we are living in the last days, because the last days run from Jesus' death and resurrection until his return. And I've got a number of kind of headings here. I'll be flicking through different passages. Some of them will pop up on the screen for you. One or two we might look up. And this is where I simply want to try and draw some things together on what all this should mean for how we live. I hope we've touched on some of the implications, more than touched, as we've gone through, but want to try and draw that together a little bit. So first of all, a perspective on life now. And I've got two headings under there, you'll see on the handout. First of all, I think knowing the future relativizes life now. Let me just give this by way of an illustration. In that great film, he says, Titanic. After they've hit the ice, the builder, you know, Thomas Andrews, the builder of the ship, architect, whatever he is, he finds out how many compartments have been flooded. And he knows it's all over. He knows they're going down. But of course, it doesn't look like they're going down yet. And everyone else is like, oh, I'm sure we'll be all right. I'm sure we'll be all right and so on. But he knows. And there's a moment, it's somewhere around that shot, where he's walking around in the magnificent lounge. And there's music playing and there's people chatting and there's the four-piece going in the corner and so on. And I think actually they know there's something going on, but they're also like, oh, you know, what a palaver, dear me, I'm sure we'll all be all right. And as he walks around, you look on his face, he's kind of removed from it. It's like he sees it all differently now. Because he knows it's all going to end up at the bottom of the ocean. And in a similar way, I think we are to have a completely different take on life. Not that we don't enter into life now and enjoy it. We should, I think. But we don't look at it the same way as other people do. We can't look at it the same way because of what we know. And when I say it relativizes life, what I mean is that people around us will actually be ultimately concerned with things that aren't ultimate. It's like people in the Titanic continuing to discuss who's wearing the nicest ball gown. And you imagine Thomas Andrews overhearing the conversation and thinking, there are more important things because of what I know. And you're caught up with trivia. And when you know the realities of the situation, and some of that absorption with detail that people will be so interested in just fades away. It doesn't even become an issue. It is relativized in light of eternity. Now, this is one of these areas you have to be very careful of, because I want to say there's nothing wrong with cheering at the trivia of the FA Cup final yesterday afternoon and enjoying that. I enjoyed it. You know? So it's not that we are to become kind of with those people who withdraw from the normal stuff of life. You know, went for early yesterday afternoon, walking with the kids, enjoying the sunshine and whatever. Great. Nothing, you know, please don't mishear me on that. But we do have a tendency to absolutize our enjoyment of life and our own purposes of in life and the fine details of life. So that my football team's success or failure actually is very determining for my life. Or my, you know, whether I'm wearing the latest fashions or not are really important rather than just, you know, I like fashion, but take it or leave it, actually. There's nothing wrong with enjoying something, but it should have that sort of open hand. I know it's a detail of life that actually is of little relevance because of what I know about eternity. Whereas around us, materialism would tell us to absolutize our possessions. Everything revolves around what you own. Hedonism would tell you to absolutize your pleasures. It's all about what fun you can get out of life. So go book that exciting holiday because that's what it's all about. Imagism, if I can coin such a word, would tell us to absolutize the image we project to others, be it to do with fashion or career success or whatever it is. And so people end up worrying over the ladders of career, success, house size, and so on. And you think of the rich fool in Luke 12 who thought he'd build himself bigger barns and then he could take life easy, put his feet up. And God says that he thought life, or Jesus says that he thought his life consisted only in his abundance of possessions and his enjoyment now. And he says, you fool. Your whole perspective changes if you know that you'll stand before God one day. If you know there is a new creation coming. That's the first sort of element of relativizing life. So let me just go back to that. There's a second element, though. I think even the pain of life is relativized. So I think of someone who's lived life not married when she desperately wanted to be. I think of a couple right now who desperately want to have kids and are facing the pretty certain likelihood they'll never be able to. I think of the person who's born handicapped. These things, and many others, the list could obviously go on, remain very painful. And the last thing I want you to hear me say is that they don't remain painful. They do, and we cry over them. But they are to be seen in relation to the new creation. And I would suggest that seen in that way, they are relativized. And they are not as paralyzing as they would be otherwise. Because if it's for this life alone I live, and I long for marriage, children, health, or whatever, and I don't get it, then I feel my life is wrecked. But it's not this life alone that I live for. Now, I'm conscious that's very easy for me to say as someone who is married, has kids, and good health. I'm very aware of that. I'll give you an illustration, though, from someone who doesn't have those things. You may well know the example of Johnny Erickson Tada, since she got married. She was made a quadriplegic at age 12 or something like that. The wonderful story of where she meets someone else who is also paralyzed, who only has use of their eyelids. It's all they can do, is move their eyelids. She can talk and so on. So they're sitting in their wheelchairs opposite each other, and they're talking. They're both Christians. And she has this little section in one of her books. So she says she begins to talk to this guy about heaven and about getting a new body there. Just imagine what they'd be like for someone who can only move their eyelids. And she said as she began to talk, he began to flutter his eyelids at her, which was his sign of kind of going, yeah, yes. And there is someone, I presume, suffering in ways I can't imagine. But their suffering is relativized, looking forward to the day when that'll all be over and they'll experience true health, true life as God wanted them to. So it relativizes life now. It also, wait for it, absolutizes life now. If I can, I'm not sure if that's a word, but I like it. What I mean by that is we know that some stuff from this life lasts and makes a difference in eternity. Life now has eternal significance. We mentioned this particularly last night in the sort of stuff on judgment. Let me just flick up a quick passage here. Some familiar words, I expect. Matthew 6:19, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. You have a way of living now where you store up treasure for eternity, which makes a difference then in eternity. There are other references Jesus makes. He talks about endure persecution now because great will be your reward in heaven. Or love other people now because great will be your reward in heaven. I think I put this on the slide, see if it comes up. 1 Timothy 6. This is to people who are rich, I take it we'd all be counted pretty rich. command them, the rich people, to do good, to be rich in good deeds and to be generous and willing to share. In this way they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. So we get into the details of these passages and say we don't really know what it will mean. What will treasure in heaven really look like? And I can't give you a really clear answer on that, I'm afraid. But I can tell you Jesus sees that to be a motivation for how we live now. So does Paul. Share your money now, because in doing so, you're laying up treasure in heaven. How you use your money now counts for eternity. In that sense, it absolutizes our decisions now, so that they have an effect way beyond what we would imagine, and for far longer than we'd imagine. Now, let me just pause there, because I actually meant to mention something earlier on this morning, because various people ask questions about the whole sort of assessment of us and how we've lived. And I just want to, with some of these things, it's a case of not necessarily holding things in tension, because I think things fit together, but it's hearing lots of different bits and pieces together. So the thing I wanted to mention was the confidence we should have on the final day. Because when we do stuff like this and do standing before the judgment seat and kind of giving account of how we've lived, it can turn the whole thing into going to see the headmaster and he's looking at our report card sort of feeling. 1 John 4 talks about the confidence we should have on the final day. It says that perfect love drives out fear. We have no fear in our relationship with God, and therefore no fear of meeting God and standing before God. And that obviously links to what we said yesterday about the verdict of the future, the justification verdict already being pronounced over us. And so we have nothing to fear on that day. And we have to hold that with that there is an assessment, like the Luke 12 parable. The master comes back and basically says, kind of, what have you done with what I gave you? And he does reward or disapprove. Not that the person's future is in doubt, not that the person should then start to be scared of their master and what he might do to them, because there's perfect acceptance and love there, but there is an assessment which makes a difference for the future. So I think life is both relativized and absolutized in those ways. We have a different perspective on life. We can sit loose to some things, and actually we give ourselves to living for God because we know it counts for eternity. That kind of flows into the next section, really, living for God. There are a variety of passages which link how we live for God now with the future. So in terms of our growth in holiness, first of all, 2 Peter 3 talks about the new heavens and the new earth coming, and then says, so then, dear friends, since you are looking forward to this, make every effort to be found spotless, blameless, and at peace with him. That is, live a life for God, being holy, not rebelling against him, being blameless before him, because you're looking forward to the day he comes back. In that wider passage, there's also the sense of the destruction and judgment on what is opposing God. So there's both the kind of, you know, opposition will finally be kind of crushed. You know that there'll be the new creation, which is the home of righteousness. So give yourself to the righteousness bit. Put yourself away from opposing God. That sort of idea. And it takes us back to where we started yesterday morning in terms of understand who we are. We belong to the age to come. We're children of light. So live like that now. To indulge in sin now is both to ignore who I am and where God is taking the world. There are other verses on kind of living holy lives in light of the end. 1 John 3, We know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. All who have this hope in them, I think that should say, purify themselves. All who have this hope in him, that is in Christ, purify themselves just as he is pure. So if you have a hope to be like Christ one day, when he returns, he'll purify you and make you like him. If you have a hope to become like Christ, you have that hope, you purify yourself now, because you have that hope for then. There will be other verses we could mention, things like, you know, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off now. Better to enter life maimed than risk the fires of hell. Be serious in fighting sin now because of the future. It also leads us to faithfulness to God now. Lots of links made between faithfulness. I mentioned the book of Revelation is written in a time of persecution. And one of its main aims, I think, is to encourage faithfulness to Jesus. But there are some other verses elsewhere. We've got lots of Revelation ones, but here's one in Luke. Jesus saying, "Do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who after your body has been killed has authority to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." And the context there is persecution. The context is that of being faithful even when being hauled up in front of courts and things. And the point is, it's not a kind of, I tell you what, you ought to be really afraid of God. That's not Jesus' point. The point is, when you're standing in front of some human authority who has power over you, you could think, oh my goodness, it's my boss, he could sack me. Don't worry about your boss, he can only sack you. Worry about God. Or in this case, don't worry about the person who could only kill you. He can only kill you. Worry about God, because there's an eternity to worry about. Justin Martyr, you can guess what happened to him, you know, had this great line, you know, "You can kill us, but you can't do us any real harm." But I think in this context, he's right. Absolutely. In fact, there's a lovely quote from a guy called Polycarp. Great name. Sounds like a sort of fish with multiple... Anyway, he was a church leader in the middle of the second century. Persecution resulted in his being questioned. If he was willing to renounce faith in Jesus, he would be free. But he understood this point. And so before a Roman consul, he was called to recant. He refused, and the consul said, "I have wild beasts. If you refuse, I will throw you to them." "Send for them," said Polycarp. The council said, "If you despise the wild beasts, I will send you to the fire. Swear and I will release you. Curse the Christ." You had to curse Christ and swear allegiance to Caesar. And Polycarp said, "How can I blaspheme my king who saved me? You threaten the fire that burns for an hour and is then quenched, but you know not of the fire of judgment to come and the fire of eternal punishment. Bring what you will." Faithfulness to Christ, knowing that there is an eternity to come, fearing God who could punish me in hell more than what a person could do to me. So I continue to acknowledge God as Lord, and I don't deny Christ, given I will stand before him one day. So living for God in holiness and in faithfulness. Evangelism. I think this has several implications for evangelism. First of all, urgency. I don't want to say much about this, and we've mentioned it already. I do think there's a hard balance for us here. You can think about some of this stuff, and you can feel like running down to the people on the desk and saying, "Have you heard about Jesus? Because I presume they're not saved. And there's eternity coming and judgment." And yet we also know that running downstairs and saying, "Have you heard about Jesus?" will probably not be very helpful in terms of their coming to faith. And so there's this kind of don't become a sort of madman who kind of has to parade the streets with a loudspeaker sort of thing, and yet a very real sense of urgency that people need to know. And, you know, I, like most people, struggle with evangelism and, you know, become tongue-tied and embarrassed and everything else. And yet, you know, Jesus, I think, spoke about judgment, warning people. And he spoke, you know, you want to ask who spoke the most about judgment in the Bible? It's Jesus, who loves people dearly. And so we must speak. We must warn people. So urgency. I think also it influences the message or sort of the content of what we say. Now, I don't know if this is an issue for you guys at St. Helens. I've got no idea what sort of currents are floating around. But something that discussions I get wrapped up in sometimes, or issues we get, is how we present the message of the gospel in terms of its benefits now versus escaping judgment in eternity. I don't know if that's an issue for you. The kind of, do I stress, oh, you'll have the Spirit in your life and you'll be forgiven and you'll be a child of God and, you know, you'll have a purpose in your life and, like, if you like, all of the what it would mean for you here and now, as opposed to become a Christian because there's a judgment coming. Is that a question you guys ever have? A little bit, maybe. Okay, a few nods. There we go. Well, I think the answer to that kind of issue, or the way we should approach that issue, comes from our understanding of eschatology. Because I think we should speak of blessings now, becoming a Christian. I mean, you know, Peter stands up and says, you know, a day of Pentecost talks about repenting and trusting in Christ, and you will be forgiven and you will receive the gift of the Spirit. And that's a challenge to us, I think. How often do we say, become a Christian, you'll receive the gift of the Spirit? You know, there's a slight danger that people find out about the Spirit in sort of, you know, year two of RML, you know, having been converted. Don't know, it's a possibility, isn't it? We speak of blessing now, new life in the Spirit, adoption, forgiveness, but we speak of them only as part of the plan, the great plan that has only come in one stage with a great second stage, in a sense the bigger stage to come, which involves escaping judgment because you have Jesus as your Lord now. And what often happens in these discussions is you get very reductionistic versions. It's become a Christian because it'll be lovely. And you think, hang on, I thought I was needed to flee the wrath to come. Or you get the prayer now, because otherwise you'll be punished in the future. Book your place in heaven. Oh, you've prayed. You've booked your place. You're okay now. Well, both are appalling, you know, straw men of each version. Because what we want to, eschatology would teach us, the verdict of the future can come into the present, and the blessings of the new age can be experienced now, but only partially. And life is now lived looking forward to the final day, which is a very complicated thing to try and explain to somebody. But in whatever form we give it, I take it that's what should set the framework for our message. So I think the answer to the message there is in eschatology. Facing death, over the page. I tell you what, some people asked, do you want to stand up for a second and stretch their legs, bad backs, that sort of thing. Now's your chance. Stand up, stretch, turn around, touch your toes, do whatever you like. You've got 30 seconds to stretch, enjoy yourself. Okay. Death. 1 Thessalonians. yes. I was once doing a mission, and I showed a video clip, and it was a video clip of the end of Captain Crowley's mandolin, where the, in the firing squad. So it's all people falling down. Video clip ends, very dramatic. You know, my next word, great. You know, sometimes you just don't think. Anyway, death. 1 Thessalonians 4, worth turning to. We've mentioned this passage in passing. 1 Thessalonians 4. Facing death, and I think both of our death and the death of other people, specifically Christians in this passage. We don't want you to be uninformed, chapter 4, verse 13. We don't want you to be uninformed about those who are asleep. It's actually quite a strong link there. It should really be something like, so that you may not grieve, as others do who have no hope. So we don't want you to be uninformed, so you won't grieve. So you, I take it this means Christians should grieve the death of their loved ones. There is to be no, oh, they're in heaven, so I'm smiling now, kind of glib. You know, you hear that sometimes, and I just think, no. We mourn, we grieve. Death is not what how God created this world. It is unnatural. We weren't made to be torn apart like this. We should cry. But we don't grieve like everyone else who has no hope. We grieve, but not in the same way. Why not? Verse 14. Because we believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so God will bring with him those who've fallen asleep. And goes on too, saying, you know, we who are alive, who are left, we won't precede those who've fallen asleep, we won't have a better position from them, the Lord will come from heaven, and so on. And encourage each other with these words. So, in facing our own death, I take it we are to be confident of being with Christ that is better by far. Philippians 1. Today you'll be with me in paradise. Very easy to say when our own death doesn't seem particularly likely. Harder when it may well seem imminent. And again, some great quotes from church history. I just love these people from church history who manage to say really great things at just the right time. I doubt I'd come up with anything very eloquent. But I think it was Cranmer who, it may have been either Ridley or Cranmer, can't remember which now. The day before his being burnt at the stake. Said, I fear my breakfast may be somewhat sharp and painful, but I trust my supper shall be altogether more enjoyable, or something. Words like that. I know, you know, it's going to be a bad morning. but then I'll be with Christ, and that'll be great. So facing our own death in whatever, not denying the pains of it, and so on. But then confidence also in the death of others, knowing that they are safe with Christ, knowing that you know, we will be with them again in a restored creation. Obviously, this is the death of Christians. We've spoken already about our concerns and questions over the death of those who aren't Christians. So we do face death differently. Then comes this attitude of expectation, which in a sense I just want to revisit what we mentioned first thing this morning in terms of how we're to wait. There is to be this looking forward in hope. And I just want to expand on that a little bit. And in a sense tie this together with where we began in terms of that overlap of the ages stuff, the now and the not yet. So, Romans 8, for example, talks about the whole creation groaning, as in the pains of childbirth. And we, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, that first bit of the Spirit that guarantees the rest, we also groan inwardly as we eagerly await our adoption, the redemption of our bodies. Well, I just want to think, do I groan? do I say to myself, I've got the first fruits of the Spirit, I have the beginnings of new life, but I groan over my sin that continues, my wrong priorities, the fallenness of this world and the hurts and the pains, the damage I'll do to other people and they do to me. Do I groan and think, I've got the beginnings and I eagerly await my final adoption, the day of redemption? Am I looking forward in hope? I think I've put it on here. That passage goes on like this. For in this hope we were saved. But hope that is seen is no hope at all, for who hopes what they already have? But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait for it patiently. You see, we're saved in hope for the future. So I love that. Who hopes for what they already have? Of course you don't. You've got it. You don't hope for it. Which means there is so much of salvation to come that we don't have yet that we should hope for. We haven't got it all. Opening Christmas presents in our family seems to take an eternity because we've got three children and a variety of presents from different members of the family. They want to see which other's got and so on. So it just takes ages going round. What we do is they're allowed to open one present before we go to church in the morning. And the rest come after we've had Christmas lunch later in the day, which of course takes quite a long time. So it's like towards the end of the afternoon is the big present opening time. And just every so often, you know, they've opened their present, they've got their little thing, they love it, that's great. And then they're kind of like, oh, I haven't got very good presents. It's like, you haven't opened them yet. You've only got one or two or whatever it is we do. And sometimes I think as Christians, you think, oh, it's tough being a Christian. Oh, life's hard as a Christian. Oh, you feel like saying, you haven't got it all yet. You're saved in hope. You've only got the down payment. The rest of it's to come. Look forward. Whereas we can so easily become very narrowly focused on here and now and what we have here and now. Romans 8 basically says to the Christian who thinks life's hard, it says, of course it's hard. You're in the overlap of the ages. You've only got the beginnings. And so all of your frustration and all of your pain should drive you to long for what is coming. You should live looking ahead expectantly. Hebrews 13 says the same. For here we do not have an enduring city, but we are looking for the city that is to come. When it says looking, it's not just like, you know, having a look, trying to see where it is. It's desiring, waiting, looking for it, thinking, come on, we want this one. So the Christian life is a life of wait. Titus 2, we live a godly life, says Paul to Titus, while we wait for the blessed hope. Now Peter in 2 Peter 3 speaks of eagerly awaiting. So, too many of us, you know, take that Hebrews 13, we do not have an enduring city here, we're looking for the one to come. Unfortunately, we can think we do have an enduring city right here. This really is home. So let's settle in and decorate. Make it our own. Well, we're to enjoy life now, absolutely. We're not to despise it or withdraw from it. But we can make it our home in the wrong sense, where we are no longer looking forward, eagerly expecting what is to come. We are no longer waiting. But it's also to be kind of patient hope. Sorry, I put these things together and then I forget which slides I have put in and haven't put in. So we just go all the way through them. There you go. That was a quick talk, wasn't it? Dum, 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 dum. Done that one, done that one. Look forward in hope. There you go. Stop there. Wait patiently. That was just by way of review. James 5:7, be patient then until the Lord's coming. You get lots of things about stand firm, or, you know, encouraging each other in light of the coming day. See, God's delay is not to cause us anxiety or angst. We're to be patient while still longing for it all the time. So it's expectant but patient. If I can put it this way, we're to be so expectant that if Jesus came tomorrow, we wouldn't be caught out. But we are to be so patient that if it's another 1,000 years, we're not disappointed. See that? Expectant, so if it's tomorrow, we won't be caught out. Patient, so if another 1,000 years, we wouldn't be disappointed. We wait, trusting his promise, knowing it'll happen. Wait patiently. Lastly, just understanding this age. Sometimes you hear Christians say, and I've kind of alluded to it already, this world is not my home. I'm just passing through. Yeah? Well, hopefully you've seen from what I've been saying so far, there's a lot that is absolutely right about that statement. Is there anything you'd want to be cautious about that statement? Is there anything potentially wrong about that statement?
From the other people that you're living with,
yep.
Around.
Being distant from people around me, be detached from them, yeah. What else could be wrong about saying, I don't really belong here? Sorry, hang on, over here first.
God's plan isn't to take us to another place,
yeah.
But to remake this one.
Yep, thank you, brilliant. And someone began to say something. Yes, as if this world doesn't matter at all. Exactly. So, we must say, well, when we say, I don't belong to this world, you have to say, well, this world in what sense? Does our world currently belong to Jesus or to Satan? Well, it depends how you look at it. You have to actually say, I think the answer is both. Everything belongs to Jesus. He's the true king. But has his kingdom arrived in all its fullness? No. Is Satan still the ruler of the air in this present age? Yes. So the world is actually under the kind of de facto rule of Satan. Illegitimate. And so in that sense that this is sort of Satan's territory, this isn't my home, it's enemy territory. Inasmuch as he rules and Jesus isn't acknowledged. And I look forward to the return of the true king. But this world, transformed by Jesus, will be my home one day, forever. Satan is a bit like a squatter who is in the process of being evicted. And one day he'll be booted right out and the world will become what it was supposed to be. And in that sense, I don't despise this world and long to escape it. It is my true home. In one sense, I'm just passing through, but you could put it differently. You could say that this, the current evil world is passing by, and the true world will come in its place. So we shouldn't try and escape the world in disgust, or, you know, lots of Christians have got into kind of sort of losing themselves through spiritual exercises and so on to escape the physicality of this world. We mustn't think of the world as irredeemable and withdraw from it. But I do think of it as where Satan has his illegitimate rule, and I mustn't be suckered in to running my life that way, like people around me will. In that sense, it's not my home. I am an exile and a stranger here. And so I think eschatology gives us that perspective on understanding the age we live in and how we should live in it. Let's stop there. Why don't we just have a couple of minutes for any questions? Then it'd be good just to break into RML groups again and spend a little bit of time maybe just really trying to fix in one or two things you want to take home and then praying them in. But a couple of minutes for questions. Sorry, hand was up at the back first, so just hold on. I'll come to you in a second. Yes. Yes.
From a Christian perspective, we know we have a sure hope of heaven when we die. I have friends, parents who've gave birth to a baby,
yeah,
died within the first day.
Yeah.
What assurance would you give to them?
Yes. Okay. So the question is, what about the salvation of children who die in infancy? You can actually go further, I'd suggest, and include, what about all miscarriages? Because I take it life begins at conception. It's an area where I'd hesitate to be kind of dogmatic, because I just think we're given very little information about it. There is actually a very strong tradition in Orthodox Christianity of believing in the salvation of all infants, those who die in infancy. And so, you know, lots of the reform, you know, I'm not sure if all names would sign up to this explicitly, but people like Calvin and Jonathan Edwards and a variety of others would all, I think, kind of sign up to that sort of thing. I can't remember the specifics, but big names throughout church history, if you like. Don't put those names on it, but big names in church history would sign up to that. They do so on a variety of bases. Some people would get into a slightly technical discussion about an age of accountability, where they think people actually become responsible for their actions. So while they're born under the reign of sin, they have not committed responsible sins or something like that, and therefore are saved if they die before that age. I really hesitate, because I don't see any evidence for that sort of idea of an age of accountability in Scripture. What we do have is, I think the only example we really have is David's son, conceived by Bathsheba, who dies after a few days. You know, David mourns and dies and so on, and then, you know, after he's died, he stops mourning. They say, "Why are you not mourning?" He says, "Well, you know, it's happened now," sort of thing. And he says, "He will not return to me, but I will go to him." It's 2 Samuel 7, I think. "He will not return to me, but I will go to him." And that would seem to be a text that points towards David's thinking that his son would be, you know, alive and well with God, and that David would go and be with him there. And so I think I'd want to say, I'd want to hold it pretty lightly and say I'm not sure. But there's one text that would give me hope, if you like, for my children. Or I simply have to say, I don't know, I leave that to God, and I know that he'll do right. Your question.
Yeah, you know, the evangelism, you gave two examples, and which is, they're both kind of appalling, the one saying, "Oh Lord, be nice," and then the other, "You'll burn in hell." Kind of.
Yeah.
Can you just recap what's the best way to go about it?
Well, okay, yeah. So I gave you the ends of the spectrum. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to escape saying, "Become a Christian because it'll be brilliant." And we're trying to escape saying, "Just book your place in heaven because that's all there is to it." I mean, of the two, I'd say the "book your place in heaven" is closer to the truth, because I think we're told to flee the wrath to come. So if I was to tell somebody one thing, I'll tell them that, not "it'll be lovely, so become a Christian," because it might not be lovely. That, I think, is actually very misleading on its own. But what I'd want to say is that God, I mean, something, the big picture, if you like, wanted to go beyond just the "trust Christ and he'll forgive you," or "trust Christ and you'll go to heaven," the big picture is God is recreating this world, and he longs for people to turn to him and be with him in a recreated world forever. And he calls you to do that now, and has made that possible through the death of Jesus. And if you do that now, you'll be forgiven by him, and he will remake you, and you'll know him as your Father. And you're to live for him now, waiting for the day when he remakes this world, and you'll be saved from the punishment that's to come, and will be in that remade world. Something like that. But that's Now, in one sense, I've overplayed, if you like, the big picture there. If I was talking to someone about why Jesus died, I'd say Jesus died in your place so that you could be forgiven, you know, and not be punished by God in the future. Now, I'm very happy with that sort of gospel presentation. I just think sometimes that can become a little bit reductionistic and miss out this big schema that we've been thinking about. And of course, I think giving that big schema, as I just tried to in my little blurb there, actually makes people kind of go, wow, God's remaking the world. There's a big scheme to this. He created it. He's remaking it. Not just, if you like, the just who is Jesus and did he die for me? In a sense, it's quite a narrow focus on what the whole picture of the gospel is. But what exactly what I said to someone would depend on the person and their interests and questions and da-da-da-da. So, other questions? Mark.
You said that this world matters, but at the same time we're living in enemy territory. I'm just trying to work out, to what extent should we, as Christians, be trying to care for this world? So not storing up treasure in heaven,
yeah.
But in terms of looking after the world creation,
yeah.
Looking after people around us socially,
yeah.
As Christians, what extent should we do it?
Yeah, very good question. And different people's eschatological schemas will, you know, influence that, like the you know, the post-mill sort of thing. Well, first of all, let's be clear: the treasure in heaven thing. How do you get treasure in heaven? By giving your money away now. Well, you know, so 1 Timothy 6. Be rich in good deeds, be generous and willing to share. So actually, you care for people, and that's actually how you show your true priorities and get treasure in heaven. So that it's not, I mustn't think that being heavenly minded and worried about that in the absolute terms means I then would neglect this world, because actually it means I'm rich in good deeds and in giving and so on. But there's kind of a bigger question here about, say, environmental stuff, caring for creation, if you like, general involvement in the kind of redemption of society sort of thing, seeing justice in society, that sort of thing. We haven't got time to get, and there's a whole number of other details going to come into play here. I think this does point us to a concern for our physical world, so I think Christians should be kind of green in the right sense, not worshipping Mother Earth, but seeing it as something we have been put in charge of as God's people, and should have a concern for. So we should be environmentally aware in that sense. I do think we should have a concern for justice in the world and so on. My question, or the issue I'd want to get into, is how all that fits together with the priority of evangelism and the spread of the gospel. Probably the best single book that starts to get into some of that is by Tim Chester, Good News for the Poor. I wouldn't agree with everything in it, personally, but it's a very good... It's written by somebody who... So the problem is that most people who write on the sort of like, let's see God's justice for the nations, a lot of people who write in that vein and say we shouldn't give up on this world and that sort of thing, and you think, well, yeah, they're also just a little bit liberal. Quite often. And so Tim Chester is unusual in that he's an ardent evangelical who says if you've got someone poor who you could feed or tell the gospel, you tell him the gospel, you know. He's very straight talking. The kingdom doesn't come through our bringing justice. The kingdom comes by the spread of the gospel and people having Jesus as their king. But he also has a very well articulated thinking about justice and care for the poor. So he's very good to read on that. I'd suggest reading that book. Yeah.
Just thinking in terms of, you know, not being asleep, being ready for the master.
Yeah.
Now, you can bet your life on it, when he does come, there'll be a lot of people who are Christians who won't be ready.
Yeah.
A lot of people probably caught up in their pet stones or whatever.
Yeah.
But they have believed Christ. They have believed that he's died on the cross for their sins. What's their position? I'm assuming that they are still... going to be safe, but he's not going to be too happy with whatever they've been getting up to at that particular moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I think they are saved. I think the basis we've discussed of our salvation is our trust in Christ, not how well we're living for him the moment he returns. I'd go back to Luke 12 and the parable of the miners, that someone is basically not being a faithful servant. And he's not in the same category as the enemies, who are going to be punished. But he does have the kind of blessing or responsibility given to him is removed and given to the guy who was faithful. So in that sense, there is disapproval from Jesus. He has not been a good and faithful servant. And I think that's the picture of the person who remains a servant of Jesus, but isn't living as one, isn't living out faithfulness in this life. And that person should not then be sort of, well, it depends on what they're doing. Because if you're flirting with sin, you should be worried about your eternal destiny at one level. You know, we mentioned the warning passages before and how we should respond to those. But the person who's just drifting off and not really living, they should be okay. I mean, yeah, they're saved. I'm sure they are. But they ought to be. It's for that sort of passage, that sort of person, Jesus, I think, spoke that parable to say, be a good and faithful servant. You don't know when I'm coming back, and I will reward people. So live for me now. I think we better stop. It'd be great to divide into RML groups. And could I suggest you maybe go round and just say one or two things you want to take away from the weekend. We've covered a lot of stuff, but I hope it's got a certain coherence to it, and there'll be one or two things you want to say. I want to live this out more, or this is the thing that's really struck me. Why don't leaders lead a discussion on those lines and then spend a few moments praying that in. So let's go to groups. Brilliant.